This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. More established cities seem to take public art for granted. In those cities, public art has become a part of the fabric of life. It's just there. And for many, it's always been there. But Charlotte is a young and growing city, a place that is very much in the process of building a collection of public art, still in the process of weaving that art into the fabric of our city. And like every kind of change, public art is not without controversy, not without its detractors. After all, it takes public money to build the collection of public art, and about 10 years ago, the city of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County both passed ordinances setting aside 1% of monies allotted for capital improvements to be filtered into public art. In that time, 67 works of art have been created or are in the process of being created. Today, we take stock of where we are, how we got here, and where we're going with public art. We try to define what public art is. After all, art is in the eye of the beholder, which can fuel whatever controversy might arise over the concept of public art, and we try to assess the ongoing impact of our ever-growing collection. Here to talk about all this is Nicole Bartlett, Program Director of Public Art at the Arts and Science Council here in Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome. Nice to have you with us. Michael Adams is a partner at Parker Poe Adams and Bernstein, LLP. They're attorneys, you know, and former chair of the Public Art Commission. Thank you for joining us again.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And joining us by phone is Edward LeBeau, who has been director of the Phoenix Public Art Program since 2005, although their official program is a few years younger than ours. I think if I did the math right, he and his staff oversee 80 projects, totaling $26 million, with $6 million more in the pipeline for a new automated train that opens in 2013 at their airport. Trains and airports. What a great idea. Why haven't we thought of that here? Edward, thank you for getting up so early in the morning to join us.
By all means, happy to do it.
Wake up now. Come on, wake up. Public, public art, as I've alluded to, can be controversial, not just because of a particular piece of art, but just because of the concept of public art. It's been the case here in Charlotte over the years and probably the case in Phoenix from time to time. But is it even more controversial today in a time where budgets are really, really tight and there's a whole faction of people in and outside of government who think that government should keep their hands out of anything but trash collection and defense?
Yeah, I really don't think so. I think that that issue has always been there. And we've been lucky in Charlotte that the leaders, mayors, and others have given public art great support and help keep the controversy at bay as much as possible. But those issues about costs and about the appropriateness of the expenditure have always been there.
Nicole?
Yeah, and I really think it's almost the opposite of that. In a lot of ways, public art can do so much with so little that we do see a lot of support. We're spending such a small amount of money, and what we get out of it, the process of engagement, the interaction between the parties, and what that breeds later can give so much, and we're putting a small amount of dollars into enhancing our community and drawing tourism. So we kind of see the opposite. We see more and more people interested in it, maybe not in huge projects, but in small ways, what can we do?
You seem to have amassed more public art in a shorter amount of time in Phoenix than we have in Charlotte. So is there any pushback on that concept of public art in Phoenix, Edward?
Well, you always get diverse opinions about that. I think there's an assumption that because it's art, everybody should agree on it. But you'll find in all public works that there's a wide range of opinions about the height of curbs, the width of sidewalks, and perhaps the location of public art. But our program got going back in the 1980s.
Oh.
Because it grew out of a sense of community leaders and elected officials that our city was falling behind other competitor cities in providing quality of life and great design for the public. So,
where did I get the idea that you began in 2005?
Well, I got there in 2005,
ah.
But I stand on a lot of taller shoulders. So it goes back to the 1980s. It was formed in 1986, and there's more than 170 projects now done.
Okay.
But your introductory remarks are to the point, is that when you mention public art, I think folks probably have an image in their head of what that means. In younger cities, that image isn't necessarily the case because we are integrating the design into the fabric of a wide range of infrastructure. And so the question that you ask, why spend money? Well, when you're spending a penny out of every buck, in the development of infrastructure that's going to be there for 50, 75, 100 years and longer. Let's look at that investment over time. Do we want to live in a city that has good design, beautiful features, interesting places to be?
So I got this wrong. I got this backwards. We were late to the table in comparison to Phoenix. Why were we so late to the table?
Well, I think we're both young cities. And to your point, the advantage in younger American cities is that we're building the infrastructure, both Charlotte and Phoenix, that a lot of older American cities got done building 50, 100 years ago. So the opportunities for artists to work with architects and engineers and landscape architects in the community to affect the design of the city is much broader and more expansive, and that's where the opportunity is.
There was public art in Charlotte prior to the beginning of this 1% fund for public art, which was mandated through those ordinances in Mecklenburg County and in Charlotte. How did that 1% ordinance come to be?
I think the real genesis of it came out of the building of the first Charlotte Hornets Arena in 1987-88. Before then, there had been public art, and public art at that time was done directly by the City Council and the County Commission. And for those who have lived in Charlotte for that long a time, there was a great deal of controversy over a piece of artwork selected for the arena, which in retrospect would have been a very valuable piece of art. And that led to a creation of a task force by Mayor Eddie Knox to decide, well, how really should we do public art and how should it be done so that we can, as much as possible, depoliticize the the process?
Let's go back. I was here then, and that work of art that was proposed for the Coliseum where the Hornets initially played was satirized and lampooned by editorial cartoonists, every morning disc jockey in Charlotte radio, and including me.
Just be honest.
Yes, full disclosure here. We all called it Gumby because it looked like a statue of that rubber eraser cartoon character, Gumby, by Joel Shapiro. Joel Shapiro is an internationally known artist, and here we are, rubes, making fun of this guy. And so that sculpture was wiped off the planet. We didn't get it. We didn't buy it. And we opted for topiaries, a series of topiaries going up and down the median between the entrance and the exit point of the Coliseum, designed by Maya Lin, who, of course, designed the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, a magnificent piece. I don't know what happened with those topiaries. They never seemed to work. As I understand it, they were bushes carved into globes at various different heights, so it would look like balls bouncing down the median. And it was supposed to be misty under it, with water spraying under it. Of course, that would never work because you'd kill the trees over time, wouldn't you, if you just kept the mist on?
Yeah, it was never a very popular work. Oh.
And, of course, when the Coliseum was taken down, they tried to sell that. I don't know how you'd sell it, but they tried to sell it, and it stenched, and they just bulldozed it. Had Gumby been there, we'd just move it, wouldn't we?
Which is exactly what was done at the airport with the Queen Charlotte statue, which, again, sometimes generates a little bit of commentary, but That's exactly right. And I think that process led to the belief that what you need is a professional process, which is why we have people like Nicole here in Charlotte and like Ed in Phoenix who can guide this process and help perhaps avoid some of that controversy.
The firestorm over the Joel Shapiro sculpture, and he didn't call it Gumby, we did. Why? Were you there then? Were you
I was not. I've only been here 4 years.
You were here, though, right?
I showed up about 6 months after it was over.
Well, I wonder why that engendered so much vitriol. It was a mean conversation. It was a funny conversation, but it was mean.
Right. I've never seen the drawings of it, so I can't comment on it, but I suspect that people didn't like it. Everybody has an opinion about art, and when people don't like art, they're going to comment on it. Now, at the same time, the Hornets were probably the biggest thing in Charlotte that had happened in a very, very, very long time, so that this was very, very public. And so you have the combination of something that everybody knows about. Once a few people make fun of it, it can snowball.
So that gave rise to the 1% idea, which includes expert opinions, and we'll talk about exactly how you decide on who's chosen to be the artist for public works and where the art should go and what projects need public art. But the 1% that came out of this, how does Phoenix fund its public art purchases?
It's a percent for art program, Mike, and it means a penny out of every buck the city spends on designing and building itself goes toward involving artists and that whole process.
So it's the same funding mechanism, and evidently this started in Philadelphia 50 years ago, if I'm not mistaken.
It began in Philadelphia. There was a gentleman named Michael von Moschitzker, and he was head of the Philadelphia Redevelopment Authority. And he looked around at the development that was occurring in American cities and in Philadelphia at the time and considered it a travesty. And he felt if you could involve artists through a percent mechanism in trying to spruce up some bare bones structures, it would be a good thing for the public. And he was also very cognizant of the fact that when people went and wanted to meet places, they often met in places that were idiosyncratic. You know, he talked about the Eagle in the middle of the Wanamaker's building in Philadelphia as being the place where everybody wanted to meet someone. And he said there has to be room in public life for these kinds of places to be made, places that may not necessarily make pragmatic sense or practical sense, but they make public sense. And he was a very, I think, articulate advocate for that. And I will tell you that when you then move into the 60s with the environmental movement and this growing consciousness of what we're doing in the area of historic preservation and also how we can improve our environment, it became a broader vision for improving urban spaces. Hmm. And that's in a nutshell where the seeds of this movement and public area came from.
Public art is many times statues and things like that in the middle of traffic circles or on street corners like we have on the square. But it's more and more cropping up in different kinds of locations. What's the most unusual place that you know of, that doesn't have to be here, for public art to be displayed in?
One that comes to mind to me is in Washington State, their water treatment facility. And they've actually put multiple projects in that facility. So you can go and you can visit and learn more about it through the art. But it does seem like
Why would you put public art in a water facility, a place that probably nobody goes? I mean, except for the employees and maybe a school tour.
Well, I think that it's an opportunity to showcase what happens there and, uh-huh. and to teach people about it. So, you know, you can do very unique things.
Most unusual place for public art in Charlotte would be? Or a place that you would not necessarily think?
Medical examiner's office.
The medical examiner's office? Mm-hmm. I didn't know about this. What's there? I don't even know where the medical examiner's office is.
It's hidden away, but this is where you would go if you were, you know, having to identify a body. And there's a very contemplative piece of public art in the lobby there. It's just quiet, and you know, if you were someone that had to go there, and few people do, I hope. Hopefully, it adds a little bit and softens your experience.
Nicole Bartlett is the program director of public art for the Arts and Science Council. We'll find out why that association exists. Michael Adams is a partner with Parker Poe Adams and Bernstein and a former chair of the Public Art Commission here in Charlotte. And Edward LeBeau is director of the Phoenix Public Art Program. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Roosters Wood-Fired Kitchen, working with local farmers, artisans, and craftsmen to present a seasonally inspired menu located uptown in South Park and online at roosterskitchen.com. And British American School of Charlotte, empowering individual achievement for students age 2 through high school, hosting an admissions open house Thursday, October 3rd from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. Details at britishschoolofcharlotte.org. Actors Theater of Charlotte is celebrating a milestone 25th anniversary this year. 25 years of producing cutting-edge comedies and dramas, and they're celebrating by producing the cutting-edge musical about a former president, Bloody, Bloody Andrew Jackson. We find out more about the musical and the 25-year history of the theater, and then we're going to talk about the Women's Intercultural Exchange Program, founded to build social capital and interracial trust. That's all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama ordered a broad review of security clearance procedures for federal workers and contractors. New questions about background checks and security credentials.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this morning and every weekday morning from 10 to noon, right here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about public art here and around the country. Our public art, as it is in Phoenix, where Edward LeBeau joins us this morning, is funded with 1% of all capital projects. All the monies for those projects in the city goes to, 1% of it goes to the creation of public art. And that's a program that started here about 10 years ago. Nicole Bartlett helps to administer that. And Michael Adams is the former chair of the Public Art Commission here. For those people who are not art lovers, who don't understand the concept of public art, why we need to spend any money on this at all, I'd like to hear from each of you why you believe public art matters. You're with the Arts and Science Council. Let's begin with you.
I think the impact and the character that it brings to our community and what it shows about our community is really important. It's kind of like Ed said, you don't want to be in a place, you don't love to be at the strip mall. Mm-hmm. You know, where do you love to be when you're here? You love to be at Imaginon Plaza with the beautiful Larry Kirkland piece. You know, there are places like that. You love to be in our libraries, and we have a Maya Godlewski piece in the Beatty's Ford Road Library that's just pieces of fabric and hanging on the ceiling, but it makes it a beautiful space and a space that you want to be in. And the process, again, the process of creating public art and bringing communities together to express what they want to express about themselves is just, you know, it creates civic dialogue.
Michael, you have a nice decorative arty tie on this morning, so you must like art. So tell me why it's important.
Well, all cultures since the beginning of time have had public art. Public art creates a sense of identity, a sense of belonging, and an ability to experience beauty and other aspects of art. And if you think of the great cities of the world, often they're identified by a great piece of art or sculpture or monument, and these things matter. The Statue of Liberty matters to all Americans. It identifies the country. And at its core, that was a piece of public art.
Mm-hmm. And we got it for free. Edward LeBeau, give me your perspective on that.
Well, you know, when you talk about public art, you're talking about a thing. And if you talk to folks in their neighborhoods and communities, they're not necessarily concerned about things. They're concerned about the fabric of the place they live, how it's connected to other places, and they want to live in communities that have beauty and distinction. And so when you have the opportunities, as you do in Charlotte and Phoenix, to integrate good design into the overall fabric of a place, you're getting an enormous bang for your buck. It pays back over time. Grand Central Terminal just turned 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And when you walk into that place, yes, it's a transportation hub. But when you stand there, you realize that it's much more than a transportation hub. It has many, many different purposes all occurring at the same time. It has artwork on the ceiling. It has sculpture as part of the pediments and architecture. So as Gusta said, this is not new. This has been going on for years and centuries. And the public art that we do is the modern version of that. Could I jump back to the unusual places for public art?
Sure.
We have art at the dump, that is, the recycling center. It's known as the solid waste transfer station. And back in the 1980s, there was a visionary head of the Public Works Department here, Ron Jensen, who knew that infrastructure had to do more than one thing. I assume Mike, do you have a smartphone?
Yes.
How many different functions does that phone have?
I'm not sure I can count, seriously.
And how many functions does infrastructure typically have?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question. A bridge is a bridge, isn't it?
Yeah, it usually has one function. But when you're spending public money, if you can expand the function of the infrastructure so that it does more than one thing, perhaps a bridge could celebrate history.
Well, in fact, we have a bridge in Charlotte. It's a highway overpass that leads from downtown to Johnson C. Smith University. That is a, at night at least, when it's lit, has become a work of art, correct?
Yeah. Erwin Rettel is the artist on that project, and really interesting story behind how that project came to be. You know, Johnson C. Smith called together a group of kind of city leaders to walk the corridor there and to start to talk about how the university could be connected back into the city and how they could really be better partners with each other, I think, and how to start to create that conversation. And they talked about this bridge and the bridge being a sort of a separator between the two places and how could they make it start to be something that connected the places. And this idea came about to do that with art. And Johnson C. Smith put money into this public art project. It's not something that we always do. We usually just have the city's money. Mm-hmm. But in this case, we have other funds on top of that. And it's something we're seeing more and more. But they came together, and Erwin Rettel was commissioned for this project and did this underpass light project that changes at night. And we've heard from people that, you know, they feel safe to walk that corridor at night.
Well, that also brings up something that Charlotte sees public art as. They see it as a stimulus for economic revitalization. How so?
Well, again, it's about creating environments that people are drawn to. So a piece of public art that I think fits that bill is the Firebird in front of the Beckler Museum. Now, that wasn't a publicly funded project in the sense that we typically operate, but it's very much a piece of public art, and it's right across the street from the Green, which was part of the construction of an office plaza. You will see people standing in front of the Firebird
getting their
pictures taken on the way to Panthers games.
Yeah.
It has become a symbol of uptown, and it is those kinds of things that create a memory and create an indescribable or sort of vague good feeling, but that helps. It helps people believe this is a city that matters.
That particular piece seems to engender a lot of excitement about it. You mentioned people. There are always people getting their pictures taken in front of the Firebird because it's such a unique piece and something you won't see probably anywhere else. It's because of that, it's become identified with the city, and people are excited about it. Which shows you that people can, even people who don't know anything about art, can get excited about art.
I think a lot. I had the public art commissioners recently each bring in their favorite piece of public art and from anything from around the country that they really loved and present it to the other commissioners so that we could learn from each other what are the things that we all appreciate out of art. And we noticed a common theme in everything that people brought in. They all had a sense of whimsy, a sense of wonder, a sense of discovery. And that was really, you know, I think a lot of public art, that's what it does. You can't necessarily deal with really deep topics when you're dealing with public art as you can in something in a museum. You know, in a museum you have an artist who has something that they're working on and they try to communicate that to you and in different ways. But when we're talking about public art, you can't do that. You're in the public realm, and you can't be singular about the experience. It can't just be about your experience as an artist. You have to broaden that, and the way that a lot of people do that is through this sense of discovery, this sense of whimsy, this you know, sense of creating moments for people.
And yet sometimes when you create those senses of whimsy, that kind of disturbs people. What comes to mind are the onion rings at Randolph and Wendover Road and the discs that seem to grow out of the ground at the Scaly Bark station for the Lynx Blue Line. People have brought those up on – callers have brought those two pieces up on this show and wondered about them. What are they and why are they there? Are they works of public art that were sponsored by the city? I know that the discs are.
The discs are – we have another program in Charlotte CATS Art in Transit program. That is 1% of just transportation dollars. Some of that funding comes through federal dollars as well, so the program is completely separate. And that funds public art along our new rail line extension and the existing rail line. And so that's part of that program. The Onion Rings, as they're called, and that's not their official name.
What is the official name? Do you know?
I believe it's Magnolia, but I think you're something
correct.
Like that.
I think you are correct.
Those were a privately funded piece of public art along with the development that goes behind them.
But that's a good example. That and Gumby is a good example. Although Gumby was met with anger, the Onion Rings are met with curiosity. What is that supposed to be? How would you describe the function of those works?
Well, I think back to sort of the controversy piece of that, you know, the ones you call the discs. A lot of times it's just about telling the story, and sometimes we don't do the great job of telling the story behind the pieces, and I think a lot of times when people understand the story, then they understand the work.
But how do you do that? Those things sit at a very busy traffic intersection. You can't put a little plaque under it that explains it because no one will ever see it.
You can't, but you can come on shows like this, and you can talk about it, and you can publicize it on a website. So the story behind those pieces, I mean, they're supposed to represent, and I'm going to get this wrong because I haven't been here long enough, and I don't know, but exactly. But they represent plow wheels, and they were built on site with Carolina clay. The community around them had a lot of input into what was going to go on there, and they wanted to look back at what happened in that community before the rail line was there. And they wanted something that would represent that, and it used to be farmland. Mm-hmm. And so the people bought into this idea, and they liked it. And it does, as you're going by and you pass by these large discs, it creates this experience in when you're in the blue line, mm-hmm. and it does the same when you're in a car. So I think the more we can tell the story behind it, the better people react.
Another example of public art in Charlotte, at least, that harkens back to what the city used to be about are the flying shuttles. These are four lighted bobbins that sit outside of the new arena, the new basketball arena. And many people might pass those by and not think of them as being works of art, but they are.
Yeah. And, you know, that doesn't matter because if it causes you to ask a question, if it causes you to say, why is this there, in itself is a way of experiencing art because that will cause some people to figure it out. And those are, you know, symbolic of bobbins and so the symbols of our past.
Our textual past.
Exactly. Yeah. And I like those. I thought that was a great addition to the street side at the arena, and it's another piece that makes the arena a more welcoming place. And again, you'll see people looking at them.
Mm-hmm. Edward, I think it was you that talked about public art functioning as a way to talk about what a place means and to give people a connection to the place. Maybe some other people have talked about that too this morning as well. In Phoenix, when you're looking at public art, are you trying to make a statement about what Phoenix is about, and how do you do that through art?
Well, it really depends on where the project might be in the community. A lot of the projects grow out of what the needs of the community might be, so they reflect those. We just finished, you mentioned the airport projects, which are now done as part of the SkyTrain. We had artists integrating works, designing floors, expansive floors for each of the immense stations at the SkyTrain. Mm-hmm. And the idea there was, not necessarily telling a story of a place, but making a place beautiful. People come to Arizona for the landscape and many other things. This was an opportunity to design spaces that establish the airport as a beautiful place for people to go and walk. And they're extraordinary spaces. Downtown, there's a monumental work by Janet Eckelman. It's part of a civic space, a new park. And it's it doesn't necessarily tell a story, but it's a landmark, much like Chicago's Bean and Millennium Park and other places, and the bobbins you're discussing that make people notice they're in a place that's distinct and different, and maybe it's interesting to come and hang out.
When you think back on Charlotte, when you go back to the Gumby period, there wasn't a lot of public art. There was Il Gran Disco, which is that big disc on the Bank of America Plaza at the square, and very little else. But since that time, there's been a lot, almost exponential growth of public art in Charlotte, particularly downtown, but also now along the rail line corridors by design. That was decided that we would do that. And as more and more public art crops up, are we seeing less resistance, more acceptance, more expectation of it being around?
I would agree that more expectation, definitely. People, I've talked to city council members and county commissioners, and they all want public art in their district. We have a piece of public art in every city and county district, but some have a lot more than others. We still have a higher concentration in the middle of the city, and the council members, you know, all the time are saying, when are we going to do a project in our district? Obviously, the projects are tied to capital projects, so if the city is funding a capital project in a corridor, that's where we're going to be doing public art. We do have the ability, though, to pool dollars and to move things around. We're going to be doing a really exciting new project with the city, a neighborhood-based project, where we'll take an existing pool of money, and that's been approved by council, and we'll go into neighborhoods that don't have public art right now, or that's going to be our priority. We're going to ask them for what they want to do in their neighborhood, how they see public art fitting into the fabric of their community, and then find an artist and pair them with them and put them through the whole public art process. So we'll start to be putting public art in places we don't have it now.
Let me share some things that have come in as we've been talking. David on Facebook says a certain percentage of money should go to the general feng shui of the area, like the island of Bali, which gets entirely swept every day. Funky Geezer on Facebook says, in recent years, public art has increasingly begun to expand in scope and application, both into other wider and challenging areas of art form, and also across a much broader range of what might be called our public realm. Charlotte's local NoDa Arts District is a perfect example. Would you agree with that?
I would. Yeah, and you know the issue with the general feng shui fund is just simply the funding mechanism that we have now, which, as Nicole said, is tied to specific projects, and so that limits the ability to do things that are disassociated from a particular capital project.
And Jim on Facebook writes, the Queen City's politicians have a less than enlightened image when it comes to the arts. Anyone remember the attack on Angels in America? Certainly not a shining moment for some of the city's political class. That was, of course, a long time ago. And another theater company is about to do Angels in America again this season, and I would wager that you will hear nothing from the public arena on the production of that play. But that was also around the time of Gumby, when we seemed to be very antsy about art, whether it was visual art or dramatic art, etc. Have we grown up?
In some respects, we have, and I think that that's a sign that we have. And we should also remember that these are things that go in and out like the tide, because to say that our elected officials have been not supportive of the arts would not be correct. If we look at these task force that created us, one was chaired by Eddie Knox, a mayor. The second one was chaired by Harvey Gantt, a mayor. The current elected officials are very supportive of public art, and we exist because there is support from elected officials.
Public art, we're talking about it. When we come back, we're going to talk about the process of how public art comes to be. How does it get chosen? Who chooses the artist? Who chooses the work? Who chooses the place? And why do certain works go in certain places? We'll find out about all of that when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Garage Door Guru, a local garage door service providing on-site repairs for garage doors, offering same-day repairs with a client's budget in mind. Details at GoGarageDoorGuru.com. And Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, blood supplier to 21 of the region's hospitals. Local patients rely on regular donors to meet blood needs. Appointments at CarolinaDonor.org. President Obama ordered a broad review of security clearance procedures for federal workers and contractors. New questions about background checks and security credentials. The topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. We're talking about public art. Perhaps you'd like to join that conversation. 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE, which translates to 9323. Or the best place, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. And we are coming right back.
Hi, I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway on WFAE. We're a fast-paced look at the news of the day where you'll hear in-the-moment conversations to take the facts and frame them in ways that make you think. We've got great guests, experts, people affected by the news, all part of the conversation, all part of your conversation, too, we hope. The Takeaway, Monday through Thursday at 2 here on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Nicole Bartlett is with us. She is the Program Director of Public Art for the Arts and Science Council. They administer the 1% for Public Art program for the city and the county. Michael Adams, partner with Parker Poe Adams and Bernstein, is the former chair of the Public Art Commission. And Edward LeBeau joins us by phone from Phoenix, where he's the director of the Phoenix Public Art Project there. As I said, you know, as it's come to be known here, we've had some growing pains over public art. People don't understand the need for it. They don't like certain pieces, etc. And in big cities, I don't know that you hear these conversations because public art, as I said, has been part of the fabric for a very, very long time. Would you say that's true, Edward? That the more art you get, the less complaint you get about it or the need for it because people just expect it to be there.
You know, part of that may be true. It's part of maturing, a city maturing, but I'd also say that it changes expectations over time. Out here, the program's 25 plus, 26 years, 7 years old now, and we get requests all the time for public art and improvements in areas, more requests than there are funds to fill. So I think as cities grow and communities grow and more public art gets out there, as you say, people have an expectation for it, and they want good design in their communities.
Well, let's go back to our growing pains. Sarah emails, I'm listening to this discussion, and I want to preface my comment by stating that I support public art 100%. However, as a Charlotte resident, I'm wondering who's in charge of selecting the artistic talent for these projects. The onion rings on Randolph Road and the oatmeal cookie-style discs along the light rail on South Boulevard, both of which we just talked about, suggest a misstep in artistic execution. At what point does public art become an eyesore for the city?
Well, let me preface by saying I don't think those are eyesores, but the selection process is about bringing in people from the community who will be most affected by the particular work and having them participate in the selection of the artist. And that itself brings a sense of identity. Neither of those two projects, by the way, are by Nicole's group. The onion rings was
private.
Although
it's public, it's public in that it is on full display, but it was privately funded. And Dan Morrill, a Charlotte historian, has emailed us with a suggestion to broaden the definition of public art because he says it's broader than publicly funded art, and that's an example of that. And the discs that we're talking about are part of the transit art funding, which is separate from the one.
So if we talk about public art in our city, let's just talk about all art that happens in the public realm. Mm-hmm. So any art that is accessible, it's free to go there. It's, you know, in a park, you can see it. Mm-hmm. You don't have to pay to get into a museum. So that would be the entire realm of public art. And then within that, we have a lot of different pieces of public. We have the city and county, 1% for art ordinances that fund public art on public land. We have the similar program with CATS. We have museums that are putting art in their public spaces, like the Nikki Disenfall, the Firebird in front of the Beckler, but it's on the Beckler property. We have private developers who put public art on their land. They don't have to go through any kind of process.
Are there any restrictions on what, if I own a skyscraper and I have a plaza and I want to put a piece of public art in the plaza, are there any restrictions about what I can put up?
There are none.
No, just the building code.
Okay. From the web, can you talk about the columns on all four corners of the Johnston Road Ballantyne Commons Parkway intersection? I remember the sculptures were there before the Ballantyne area was developed like it is now. That's because that was Stonehenge before Ballantyne was built around it. That's the impression that it gives. Can you talk about those pieces?
I don't know much about them, but I mean, of course, they're public art. They're art in the public realm. They're not part of the 1%. They're privately funded.
Yeah, I believe the developer did that. I'm also not familiar with that, but I believe the developer did that, again, to create a sense of identity at that place. And, you know, we have that full gamut. My favorite piece that's somewhat private is the Hugh McManaway statue right there at Providence and Queens and Queens, which is decorated every week and is probably one of the most engaging things, and tells a story about, you know, a man who had his challenges, who directed traffic at that intersection a long time ago. And that is, to me, an example of how public art brings the community together and creates a fun thing to have.
And that statue is privately funded, but it's public because it's sitting there at the intersection.
And
correct?
It is public. It was given to the city, and so the city maintains the piece. When it, if you all remember, yes. I think it was last
damaged.
Year, the piece was damaged.
In a car accident.
And the city, you know, knowing that everyone cherishes that piece, and it's their duty to repair it, they did that. They brought the artist into consultation, and the piece was repaired.
Well, that's, you just mentioned, it gives you a sense of place. That's the whole purpose, one of the key purposes, at least, of public art, isn't it? It's to give you, when you're standing in front of it, it gives you a sense of where you are right now at this moment, but also it gives the city an identity. Because that Firebird's a great example of that. The columns and arches at Ballantyne are an example of that. You know you're in Ballantyne.
Indeed.
Well, Mike, if I could jump in from out west here. You know, just the fact that people would decide to call something onion rings or oatmeal cookies or whatever they might be, it's kind of a way that they're, even if they don't say they like the work, they're adopting it to their own terms. You know, they call the Cloud Gate in Chicago the Bean. Out here, we have the Eckelman as part of the civic space, and it's people call it the jellyfish.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lady calling me up repeatedly for months after the Eckelman sculpture went in and saying, you know, I hate that thing. Every time I take visitors to see it, I just don't understand. And I said, well, why do you keep bringing people to see it? And she said, because it's interesting, but I hate it. And so, in a way, it becomes a symbol of a place. It becomes a thing people notice. And as they notice, they visit. Maybe they absorb it a bit at a time. It's not like standing, as Nicole said, in front of a painting or a sculpture in a gallery, but you experience it over time.
And I don't hear many people complaining about, although it's been removed temporarily at the airport, the Queen Charlotte statue has been removed because they're building parking decks around it, but they're going to put it back. And it's a statue that's very unusual because Queen Charlotte's not just standing there. She's holding her crown way up high in her hand, and she's bent over as though somebody had thrown a basketball at her midsection. And I guess that's to indicate that she's leaning forward into the winds created by the exhaust of the aircraft taking off and landing. But no one complains about that.
No one complains about that, and you'll see that in pictures of the city. And,
right.
And we hope that we get more pieces of public art that are identifiable enough that they become part of the pictures of the city. And that one is still out at the airport. I saw it the other day. It's just between two of the parking decks.
Yeah. It'll be incorporated into the new parts of the airport that go in later.
Okay, let's take a phone call with Sarah, who's been holding on for a very long time. Sarah, welcome to the program. You there, Sarah? Maybe
I'm
not.
Here, yeah. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I actually worked for a year here in the Arts and Science Council's program before the economic crash of 2008-9. Hi, Nicole.
Hi.
And hi, Michael and
get
Edward.
On with it. Get on with it, please. Get on with it.
Sorry about that. Well, I just wanted to give some perspective going back to the controversy question, because when I came into the field in Denver in 2001, Joel Shapiro... Actually, they had a temporary exhibit of sculptures similar to what you're talking about, the Gumby. And the reaction was largely the same. It was largely lampooned in the press, and there was a lot of controversy. But the situation was slightly different in that it was a temporary installation. And one thing that colleagues have talked about over my career in public art is how do you get a community that may not be as familiar with the idea of public art to accept it? And so I wonder if you guys could sort of discuss that that idea of temporary installations as a way to get people experiencing access to it without a feeling of being so threatened.
Nicole.
It's not something that we've done a lot of temporary projects here. We have done a lot of what I would call pilot projects. Mm-hmm. So having an artist go into a neighborhood and just working with the children in the neighborhood or the people in the neighborhood and creating small pieces of public art, collages and things like that, to just get them into the idea of art in general. We'd like to do more temporary projects here. It's something we're talking about. We're very, very fortunate. Jim Gargis and Lee Jones at the county and Parks and Rec, we have a pool of money for new projects there, and they're pushing us to think of new ideas and what would be exciting in our parks. And they're open to kind of everything. And we've talked about doing some temporary projects, a series of temporary projects.
We don't really have any temporary projects. We do have one that changes from time to time. And it's I don't even know what you call it, but it's on Trade Street toward the Gateway Center and near the courthouse. And it's those hoops of fabric. And the fabric changes seasonally, I believe. So the look of the project changes seasonally. I'm not sure who's responsible for doing that, but
so Wind Sculpture is the piece that you're talking about, Jack Pentis, and that piece was funded by Queen's Table. It's a private philanthropic group funding art throughout the community, and we're about to do some work on that piece. It's been ignored for a bit of time, and it needs some updating. Mm-hmm. But yes, it changes.
What about temporary art, Edward LeBeau? Do you have any in Phoenix?
We do. We have a program of temporary works. One of the disadvantages of being a public agency is that when you're spending capital money, that is bond money, there needs to be a permanent aspect to that.
Sure.
And so the temporary works that we do, we have to make sure they can live in some form for a period of years, whether it's through documentation or on the web, that kind of thing. But we've been able to develop a temporary program, and it's been very successful. There's a project occurring right now with an artist, and she's involved blanket makers from throughout the nation and two provinces in Canada, to develop a huge blanket to put on an empty lot in Phoenix, and then the blankets will be disassembled and given to homeless providers. Part of this has involved enormous involvement from communities of weavers, blanket makers, knitters who've never done public art before. So when you're talking about things that have never been done before or people's unfamiliarity with it, this is one of the ways where people can get involved in thinking about spaces in their community that is sort of a door that public art opens to.
Now, we had a series of very oversized rocking chairs throughout the city at one point, and that would be an example of temporary art, it seemed to me, because they were all decorated differently, and they were in different locations, and I've forgotten why they were there, but they were there for about a year, and then they went away. Talk about the process before we run out of time, because you're in charge, Nicole, of public art, and you work for the Arts and Science Council. They've been charged with administering this 1% for public art. What's the process? How is it determined which new buildings, streetcar projects, whatever it may be, how is it determined what gets art?
So we start with the allocation. It's got to be in the public realm. So when we're talking about capital dollars being spent on a new runway project, we don't get 1% of that. We only get projects in the public realm. So police stations, fire stations, things like that, courthouses. We get 1% of just construction dollars. So we have an allocation. I meet with city or county staff, the designer on the project, the project manager, and we start to talk about where the most applicable place for public art in that particular project would be. And we might start to concentrate on certain areas. We then bring those to our public art commission, and we talk further about the ideas. We approve a work plan. The public art approves a work plan. We present that to city council or to county commission. And once the kind of overall concept for the projects is approved, we start to put together an RFQ or an RFP asking for artists and developing goals for that project, and that's done with the Public Art Commission. And we put together a panel of people to select the artist, and that depends on the project. So, you know, if we're at a police station, we're going to have people who work in that police station. We're going to have the project manager, the designer. We're going to have people in that community working to select the artist. And then once we select an artist, we go through a process of design. There's checkpoints along the way where the Public Art Commission has to weigh in and make sure that the artist is following the goals of the project and is, you know, that there's an overall sense right. of beauty in the project.
How much money in an average year does 1% bring in?
Well, next year, let's say the city, I think it's $212,000.
Which is not a lot.
It's not a lot. I mean, the overall city budget for next year is
a lot.
$195 million or something like that.
It's a lot.
Yeah, so it's not a lot.
So over time, 67 art projects over the time of this 1% for public art, how much money have we spent on art? Do you know?
By about $5.2 million.
Now, how many emails? Is there a map of all the public art in Charlotte? I know that there's a GIS map in Phoenix. Do we have a map?
We've got a number of different ways for people to find out about public art. We have public art walking tours for the Uptown pieces of art. We have a scavenger hunt that we just put together for the Uptown art. If you go on a site called the Public Art Archive, we've got about 20 of our pieces on there. Katz has a lot of their pieces. You can find the public art near you on that archive. I commend the city and the county. Their staff has been working to put all of our public art on GIS, just like they have in Phoenix. It's going to be a great tool, not just for our citizens, but a great tool for us within city and county to figure out where to put pieces.
Where are we going from here? Where will we see new pieces cropping up in the near future?
We've got a great project going in along North Tryon, the corridor just outside the city. Wonderful artist Sheila Klein is working with the city on that project, and we'll be seeing art weaved throughout that new streetscape project. So that's a really exciting one. New parks projects. We have a wonderful piece by Richard Hunt that will be going into Bearden Park in the future.
Mm-hmm. By the way, Bearden Park is getting rave reviews, so I know you're not responsible for that. But
actually, we are responsible, partly for that. Nori Sato, an artist, worked with Land Design as part of the Public Art Commission on that project. So,
well, congratulations, then. Nicole Bartlett, Program Director of Public Art for the Arts and Science Council, Michael Adams, former chair of the Public Art Commission, and Edward LeBeau, director of the Phoenix Public Art Projects in Phoenix, Arizona. Thank you all for the hour.